Thursday, December the 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, remembering former U.S. President George H.W. Bush.
What a life. What a career. It is amazing. And, of course, Bush was our last World War II veteran to serve as president.
Another violent protest in Paris.
A weekend which saw some of the worst street urban violence in the center of the city for years.
Also ahead, Hanukkah begins, a Botanic Garden Christmas display, plus something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Former U.S. President George H.W. Bush will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda starting today as Americans honor the life of the country's 41st president. He died late Friday at the age of 94 after several years of failing health. Mr. Bush, who served a single term as president in the White House from 1989 to 1993, will receive a state funeral on Wednesday at the National Cathedral here in Washington. That will be followed by burial Thursday at the Presidential Library in the state of Texas. Mr. Bush lost his reelection bid in 1992 and had these words to say before leaving Washington.
I've been privileged to hold a number of high-level posts over the years, but now that my political days are over, I can honestly say that the three most rewarding titles bestowed upon me are the three that I've got left: a husband, a father, and a granddad.
Larry Sabato is an American political scientist and political analyst. He also is professor of politics at the University of Virginia, where he is the founder and director of the Center for Politics. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Dr. Sabato for his thoughts on H.W. Bush.
He's an example of a president who ages well, and I don't mean physically aging, I mean aging for the history books. It's pretty obvious as people look back and as people are recollecting the Bush presidency, it looks a heck of a lot better than it did at the end of it. Bush, of course, was defeated for re-election, and most people at the time considered him a failed president. But now I think we can see in retrospect that he was actually quite successful, arguably the best one-term president we ever had. He may be tied with John Adams and James K. Polk, but he's at least up at the very top end of a pretty large group of one-term presidents. So it's funny how history works, but the good thing is that with time, you could have reconsideration.
A stellar career, starting with the as a young man in the U.S. Navy during the Second World War, a congressman, CIA director, ambassador to China, vice president, and now president. Quite a career.
What a life. What a career. It is amazing. And, of course, Bush was our last World War II veteran to serve as president, so he ended an era. But he was a hero in World War II, but he was the son of a senator. And as the son of a senator, he grew up in a political household. So no one was surprised when he started running for office from Texas in the 1960s. What people often forget is he wasn't very successful. He lost two Senate races. He won two races for the House of Representatives. But he went from there to the United Nations. He also served as a liaison to China before we had a full-fledged ambassador. And finally, he was head of the CIA. Then he served after the Carter term. He served two terms as vice president, one term as president. It ended badly with his defeat, but I think all of that was washed away in 2000 when his son was elected president.
You remember the famous words, "Read my lips, no new taxes," but wasn't that really overshadowed by the fact that he helped win the Cold War, or presided over the Cold War, and then, of course, the coalition against Saddam Hussein?
Absolutely. I was 20 yards from the podium when George Bush uttered those words at the Republican National Convention in 1988. And even then, people wondered whether conditions would permit him to keep them. Of course, he did not keep the promise. He did not hold to those words. And it hurt him badly in 1992. Oddly enough, the other thing that hurt him badly was the fact that he skillfully helped the end of the Cold War. He did not grandstand. He didn't run to Berlin to dance on the wall once it had fallen. he realized that these new emerging countries needed time and space and no goading, no grandstanding from the United States to make their way. But essentially, it eliminated foreign policy as a major consideration in the 1992 election, and that helped Bill Clinton, who had no foreign policy experience.
AP leads their story, Bush mourned as great statesman, man of uncommon decency.
Well, to be honest, at one point in history, it would not have been exceptional to have a president who obeyed and appreciated the norms of the American system and of the presidency, who was civil, who was kind to people, and who rose above petty squabbles. But, you know, things have changed, particularly in the last couple of years. And the contrast between George H.W. Bush and the current president could not be more stark. People instantly recognized that as they thought back on George Bush's term. I think even Donald Trump has recognized it. He's been a little quieter than usual since President Bush passed.
The president's legacy?
The president's legacy is pretty significant. No one ever remembers or mentions the Americans with Disabilities Act, which occurred during Bush's term. Bush pushed hard for that, and it was his greatest legislative achievement during his term. That made an enormous difference for the millions and millions of Americans with disabilities, and it's also had an effect around the globe. Many other countries have modeled their own laws on the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Larry Sabato is an American political scientist and political analyst. He's also a professor of politics at the University of Virginia, where he founded and is the director of the Center for Politics. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. For the third straight week, demonstrations took to the streets of Paris over the weekend in frustration about escalating taxes, especially on gasoline, and the leadership of President Emmanuel Macron. AP's Zaria Shackley has more.
Protesters, including some wearing black hoodies, piled up large plywood planks and other material in the middle of a street near the Arc de Triomphe and set the debris on fire. Police fired tear gas and used water cannons to try to push back the protesters who gathered around there. Some demonstrators responded by throwing large rocks. The monument was seen late in the day, tagged with the words, "The Yellow Vests Triumph," in reference to the fluorescent vests protesters wear. I'm Zeria Shakili.
And for more on what happened on the streets of Paris and elsewhere in France, VOA's Lori London speaks with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field.
You've really got two separate pictures. You've got the picture here in Paris, where you have had a weekend which saw some of the worst street urban violence in the center of the city for years. Now, that was really a lot of protesters who'd come from outside of the capital, come into the capital to protest, plus you'd also had ultra-left and ultra-right-wing groups coming in and infiltrating that so-called yellow vest protest movement. Now, they had this 12-hour spree in the center of Paris where they played cat and mouse with the police. Buildings were set on fire, cars were set on fire, banks were looted, shops were broken into. And that was pretty much the picture that everyone had of the capital. Outside the capital, you've got a far more clearer picture of what this actual protest is, which is you've got at least a dozen cities and towns across the country where there have been large demonstrations of just everyday folk going into the center of town and protesting against higher taxes and falling living standards. And there you're seeing little bits of violence, but not very much. And generally what you're seeing is just groups of people, you're protesting and blocking entrances to fuel depots, picketing outside town hall. So you're really seeing that across the country. At the base of all this is just this feeling that President Emmanuel Macron is now perceived as having favored the rich, that his personal manner, in a way, is at best aloof, at worst arrogant. That's how it's seen by these people. And they just feel that all these weeks of protests have got them nowhere, and he's just not listening to them.
I'm not sure about in France, but I know here if some of the things that were happening here or happening there, we're hearing about, it might deter from their message. We're hearing about torched cars, smashed windows, looted stores. Is it hurting their message?
This, I think, is one of the aspects that President Macron is hoping for. And in particular, when you look at some of the destruction that was done during the demonstrations at the Arc de Triomphe, the monument to the Republic of France, the monument to the war dead. And I think Emmanuel Macron is hoping that the destruction there, the fact that this monument was tagged, that protesters went inside and ransacked, I think he's hoping that may prove to be a turning point, that ordinary protesters will feel, oh, enough is enough, this has gone too far. So that, if anything's going to cause them to think again about whether or not they come out next Saturday for more demonstrations, it's going to be that, because there has been a lot of disgust that has been expressed in many ways as to how much damage and how much sacrilege was caused to that great Arc de Triomphe monument.
Catherine Field is a Paris-based journalist, and she was speaking with VOA's Laurie London.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Jews around the world are beginning the Hanukkah celebration. The 8-day-long Festival of Lights marks the rededication of the Temple of Jerusalem in the 2nd century B.C. after Jewish guerrillas defeated the armies of tyrannical Syrian and Greek rulers. And here in Washington, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke presided over the Hanukkah celebrations outside the White House, lighting first candles at the National Menorah, and from the stage came many seasonal songs, including the dreidel song. By the way, a dreidel is a four-sided spinning top played with during Hanukkah.
And when it's dry and ready, oh, dreidel, I shall play.
It has a lovely body with legs so short and thin. And when it's all tired, it falls and then I win.
Oh, dreidel, 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 I made so short and thin. Oh, dreidel, 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 it falls and then I win.
And it was a lot of fun. A guy dressed up like a dreidel. It was fantastic. President Trump released a message saying he and First Lady Melania had sent their warmest greetings to our Jewish brothers, he said, and sisters. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier, well, he lit a candle there, a 10-meter-high menorah that's in front of Berlin's Brandenburg Gate. It is Europe's largest menorah. And for the first time in many years, Jews in Kazakhstan were allowed to light a large menorah outside the Pyramid of Peace and Reconciliation. Every year, thousands of visitors come to the U.S. Botanic Garden here in Washington, in fact, just across the street from VOA, to enjoy the Christmas decorations, the holiday plants, and model trains. This year, the garden has its largest ever display of toy trains chugging around historic railway stations from the U.S. And as we hear from VOA's Deborah Block, the railroad stations are made of some unusual materials.
It is cold outside in Washington, but there is a warm glow inside the U.S. Botanic Garden during the Christmas season. This year, the garden is featuring 31 replicas of historic U.S. train stations built from the 1800s to 1970.
Trains really celebrate the holiday season for people from 2 to 92.
Kashmira Bhatti came to see the trains with her son.
He likes that the trains are moving, and he can see the train station and the surrounding of the train station, too. So it's more like an educational thing for him, and plus entertainment, too.
The amazing displays are reminiscent of the popular model trains that circled under Christmas trees for 50 years during the last century, from 1910 to 1960. And while the trains may be a new experience for kids, they bring back nostalgia for adults old enough to remember them.
And I think there's still a little bit of an imaginative era associated with trains in the United States. It's something that not everyone rides all the time anymore, and so I think there's a little bit of whimsy associated with them.
Most of the train stations are still in existence, including Montana's East Glacier Park Station, the beautiful Cincinnati Union Terminal in Ohio, and the very steep Pikes Peak Cog Railway in Colorado. If you look closely, you will also see something else that is unique about the railroad stations and other structures. They were constructed using a variety of plant-based materials.
So the buildings are made out of things like acorns or cinnamon sticks, grapevine tendrils. In fact, there's more than 100 different type of plant parts that are used to make these.
Besides the historic train stations, the Botanic Garden is also featuring its spectacular plant-based collection of Washington landmarks, which include the White House, U.S. Capitol, and the U.S. Supreme Court, along with the newest addition, the city's Union Station. This visitor was admiring the intricate workmanship that went into making the landmarks and railroad stations.
The ingenuity, the creativity. I love all of the natural elements. It's fantastic.
Also showcased are two of the largest indoor decorated Christmas trees in Washington, as well as more than 3,000 poinsettia plants, also known as the Christmas flower. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
You should check out the video of this report. You can go to voanews.com and look for the train story. It's there on the lead page. Also ahead, the sounds of Al Wilson. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA retired its Kepler spacecraft at the end of October, but among its last observations on February 4, 2018, the Planet Hunting Space Telescope helped give teams of astronomers an extraordinary look at the very first moments of a violent stellar explosion called a Type 1A supernova. Past research indicates that typical Type 1A supernovas usually grow in brightness over the span of a couple of weeks before it fades away, but the astronomers noticed that this particular supernova was unusual because it quickly brightened in just a few days after its initial explosion. Scientists considered Type 1A supernovas important to understanding the workings of space and are used as cosmic rulers to measure distances across the universe. To make their observations and develop their findings, the teams of astronomers used both space and a variety of ground-based observatories. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music.
On her way to work one morning, down the path alongside the lake,
tender-hearted woman saw a poor half-frozen snake. His pretty colored skin had been all frosted with the dew. Oh, well, she cried, I'll take you in and I'll take care of you.
Al Wilson was an American soul singer, often remembered for his northern soul theme, The Snake.
Take me in, tender woman. The Snake. Now she wrapped him up all cozy in a coverture of silk and then laid him by the fireside with some honey and some milk. Now she hurried home from her work that night as soon as she arrived. Now she found that pretty snake she'd taken in had been revived. Take me in, oh tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman. Sigh, the snake.
Al Wilson was born in the state of Mississippi, where he often performed in school plays and sang in talent shows. While he was in high school, he and his family relocated to San Bernardino, California. And after graduation, he spent 4 years touring with Johnny Harris and the Statesmen. Then he joined the U.S. Navy. Later, he developed a stand-up comedy routine in case, he said, he wasn't very successful as a singer. But that didn't happen. Among his many hits is the medley, I Won't Last a Day Without You and Let Me Be the One.
Some sleepless night, if you should find yourself alone, let me be the one you run to, girl. Let me be the one you come to when you need someone to turn. Day after day, I must face a world of strangers where I don't belong, and I'm not that strong. It's nice to know that there's someone I can turn to who will always care, and you're always there when there's no getting over that rainbow, when my smallest of dreams won't come true. I can take all the madness that the world has to give, but I won't last a day without you. Oh, baby, let me be the
In 1966, Wilson did an a cappella audition for singer-songwriter Johnny Rivers, who produced sessions for Wilson that yielded a number of R&B hits like We're Having a Party. Wilson disappeared from the music industry after 1973 when he released his major hit, Show and Tell, which was written and produced by Jerry Fuller, the man behind the run of hit singles for Gary Puckett and the Union Gap in the late 1960s. Show and Tell topped the Billboard Hot 100 chart.
These are the eyes that never knew how to smile till you came into my life. And these are the arms that long to lock you inside every day and every night. Girl, and here is the soul of which you've taken control. Can't you see I'm trying to show love is right? Oh, show and tell, just a game I play when I wanna say I love you.
Any way you look at it, Show and Tell was Al Wilson's signature song. The song and the album went to the top of the Billboard R&B chart and earned a gold record. Al Wilson died in April 2008 of kidney failure in Fontana, California. He was 68 and is widely remembered today by the thousands of downloads of his super hits.
That can't help calling your name in the middle of the night. Here is the man who needs to know where you stand. Don't you know I've done all I can? So decide. Oh, show and tell. It's just a game I play when I wanna say I love you, girl. So
Show and Tell is one of those super downloads, too. I mean, lots of people download that song. This many years after it was popular. Love it, love it. Al Wilson. Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman. We're in Washington, hoping you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Al Wilson.
Here's the song.
This is Today in History. On December 3, 1967, surgeon Christian Barnard performed the first human heart transplant at Grootschuur Hospital in Cape Town, South Africa. A 53-year-old grocer dying from heart disease received the transplant. He died 18 days later after drugs given him to keep his body from rejecting the heart left him vulnerable to pneumonia. On this day in 1984, in Bhopal, India, the leak of a highly toxic pesticide caused one of the worst industrial disasters in history. A series of mechanical and human errors at a pesticide plant operated by the U.S.-based Union Carbide Corporation allowed a cloud of lethal gas to escape into the air. A 500,000 people were exposed to the gas, and at least 3,000 were killed immediately. The Indian government reports another 20,000 have since died from the exposure to the gas. On this day in 1895, Anna Freud, the Austrian-born psychologist who pioneered the field of child psychoanalysis, was born. The daughter of Sigmund Freud expanded her father's discipline to the systematic study of the emotional and mental life of children. On this day in 1965, the British rock group The Beatles released their sixth album, Rubber Soul. The album is regarded as one of the greatest albums in pop music history. On this date in 1968, American television network NBC aired a special featuring Elvis Presley. The program is credited with launching a comeback for the former teen idol. And in 2012, at least 475 people were killed after Typhoon Bopha made landfall in the Philippines. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.